Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today. Hi, OCD family community. We're already halfway through January, and it's interesting how sometimes the days can feel endless, but then the weeks just fly right on by. But I'm excited that it's Friday, because in addition to starting the weekend, it's also a day when I can count on my time with you, family. And today is no exception, as we welcome Dr. Michael Alsey to our family table. Because as Mike is going to share, our OCD warriors have a beautiful humanity to them. So get comfy, fam, because we're going to chat all about the upside of OCD, and I can't wait for you to hear more. I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent, and let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started. Okay, fam. All right. Wow. What a week, huh? What a month. What a start to 2025. Last week, we paused our regularly scheduled programming to talk about mental health tips for managing crises, particularly as we heard of the growing and continued devastation in the Los Angeles area of the United States. For any newer family joining, I went to grad school and lived for at least 10 years in Pasadena alone or worked there, which more or less is within greater Los Angeles. And parts of Pasadena and the neighboring city of Altadena was absolutely obliterated in the Eaton Canyon blaze, which is still very much active, and one of many fires, I'll add. So my continued thoughts and prayers are with people, friends, and colleagues of Los Angeles, or any family listening that has had to endure similar crises. I've heard that the episode I produced last week has been helpful for people, even folks without OCD, and I'm glad. But it's interesting, family, because as I prepared today's podcast for you, I realized that my special guest, Michael, though I'll say my brain latched on to Mike, and as you'll graciously hear, he was fine with that. But Mike and I talked a lot about the metaphor of a fire. And we recorded way before these fires started, although arguably in LA, fire season is a yearly occurrence. But we had this chat long before the blazes that are taking place at present. So that was really a meaningful reminder for me, and I found the irony and the helpfulness to be really pertinent in the wake of the current blazes. And I'll be interested to hear how it resonates with you too, family. But before we jump into our conversation, I want to tell you more about Michael, as well as his latest book and the primary focus of today's conversation, The Upside of OCD. And per usual, but also just as a housekeeping note for anyone newer to our family gatherings, I'm going to have all the deets where you can find out more about Michael, his books, and more over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. Because I know how we listen to podcasts, family. I'm a big pod listener myself. But also, just a bonus note that if you happen to be watching or listening over on YouTube, I always have that episode's blog located in the description below, so you can just check that out. And hey, if you'd be up for it, would love it if you would be willing to like and subscribe or even say hi in a comment or wherever you're enjoying your podcast, if you would subscribe or be willing to download the show. It really does help with all the algorithm things. Helps you know when there's new episodes available, and ultimately then it makes it more visible for people trying to find this community as support. So thanks in advance for your consideration there. Okay, so Michael and I crossed paths through treatment provider groups, and after, Stuart, Ralph, and I of the OCD Stories had a chat that vibed with Mike's refreshing take on the upside of OCD. So let me tell you a bit more about the good doc, and then we can dive right in. Michael Alsey is a clinical psychologist in Tarrytown, New York, and a mental health educator at the Manhattan School of Music. He is the author of Therapeutic Improvisation, How to Stop Winging It and Own It as a Therapist, as well as The Upside of OCD, Flip the Script to Reclaim Your Life. So without further ado, family, let's meet Mike. Well, welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and I'm excited today because I'm meeting, for the first time, although we've had a little bit of conversation online, Dr. Michael Alcy, who is out with his new book, The Upside of OCD. And I'm excited to hear more about how you wrote this. This isn't the only book that you've written, as we were talking before recording, and just talking about providing treatment options and hope for people suffering from OCD. And so first of all, welcome to the show, Michael. I'm going to do that the whole time.
Call me Mike.
Okay,
call
Mike.
Call me Mike for the
okay.
whole interview.
That's what it is. That's what it's,
we imprinted on it.
Okay, we did. Welcome.
Great to be here with little girl.
Yes. Okay. So again, we are going to be talking about this amazing book that you just wrote just recently, like hot off the press. And I'm really excited to dive into this and to learn more. But before we get into that, I have been so fascinated about learning how people got into treating OCD, what that journey was like. Have you always treated OCD? Or what really piqued your interest and brought you to this specialty, Mike?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm both an insider and an outsider. I started with OCD treatment when I was in grad school because my dissertation was on OCD. I was curious about, you know, I worked with Dean McKay in graduate school, and then I did a training with Steve Phillipson. And so I learned about all the classic OCD treatments. Exposure response prevention at the time was the most important one. And, you know, I started with working with people on that function, but I also was trying to learn everything in every angle of OCD that I could. So while I was taking courses in behaviorism and cognitive behaviorism, I was also looking at relational approaches more generally and reading Freud's case study on OCD. And the other thing is, personally, I'd always struggled with certain aspects of OCD, certain kind of perfectionism or comprehensiveness, reassurance, you know, that kind of thing. My mom growing up had a lot of contamination, OCD, and some of the other classic OCD symptoms. So it was always personally very interesting to me. But for many years, it was a side thing that I just did because I've always been interested in it, but I was never in the community.
Yeah.
That's when I started. So it almost gave me this freedom to be able to explore it from all these different angles. And so I've come back, so to speak, to the community now writing about it to say, hey, look, there's a lot of what I've discovered and rediscovered in this that I think you'll find interesting.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And family, let me just, so first of all, Mike, you're very humble because he's like, oh yeah, I studied under Dean McKay with Stephen Phillips and holy cow. Okay, let me explain this, family. So Dean McKay is huge in research and he's a part of our treatment community, and a lot of people look to his wisdom and insight for interpreting data, for advancing evidence-based treatment, et cetera. And then Stephen Phillipson, if you've ever heard of the term pure O, then you have heard of Stephen Phillipson, even if you didn't realize he was the person that really helped expand a profile for what we consider to be pure O. So that's really, really interesting. I was like, welcome. You're more of an anchor here than I am, for sure. And not that it's a competition, but I that's impressive.
Well, it was hardcore, right? But what I loved about it is it gave me a sort of sense of what is the most in-depth, evidence-based way of looking at it. But I've always been a very creative, out-of-the-box, synthesizing thinker.
Yeah.
And a little bit of a poetic sensibility. So, you know, it's funny, when Dean McKay had me write my dissertation, he's like, all right, I'll help you with the CBT stuff and the cognitive behavioral side of it. But for the psychodynamic or attachment theory that you're going to use for this, you got to go out. And I'm like, that's fine. I just want to I want to mash them up and make something more interesting. And so it gave me a real experience from the very start of my career of really delving into the stuff on a lot of different levels. And it took me a while to really cook that up into something that I felt solid about putting out into the world.
Yeah. It's interesting because before I came into treating OCD, did a lot more psychodynamic work. And I had a specialty before OCD, which was the early intervention birth to five age, which is a lot of attachment work as well. And it's almost a dirty word
psychodynamic treatment in the CBT world. And so it was kind of weird because I was like, I got in there and I was like, I don't dare tell people that I've done psychodynamic therapy. And I think I did great therapy. But I also think that OCD is so interesting and the CBT is certainly really important. And it sounds like what we're going to be talking about today then is blending some of the CBT with some of more of the relational background and going a little deeper, which almost reminds me a little bit from what I've learned thus far about rumination-focused ERP, which is exposure and response prevention. For anybody new joining, that's what ERP stands for. And I wonder, have you checked out Dr. Michael Greenberg's work on RF-ERP? Because that is also is the only other kind of zone where I've noticed some psychodynamic work, not even sneaking in. He's like, I'm intentional, no sneaking.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I've heard of Greenberg, and I honestly think what's beautiful about this is I think every great scientist is a great artist, and every great artist is a great scientist. So I think when you're looking at this stuff, like if you look at the word exposure response prevention, right, much of what the mainstay of OCD treatment for those who are listening is like getting through, staying through the challenge of whatever triggers you.
Right.
And trusting in the process that by approaching it in a compassionate and, you know, considered way helps you not only come through the fear, but have a new experience, which is great. But we can do exposure to thinking differently, even like you said, and it could be an exposure exercise for a CBT therapist to acknowledge a psychodynamic intervention. It could be an exposure exercise for someone to look at different feelings that they've never opened up.
Yeah.
That come alongside what happens to be triggering them with their OCD. So yes, I'm a little bit of a rebel in wanting to kind of say, what are the boundaries matter with this? Because we know a lot about OCD, but we also don't really know as clearly all these different elements. So why not keep on exploring?
Yeah.
And so for me, the idea of, well, one man's exposure is another man's avoidance, right? And so to me, like it doesn't, I think there's ways in which we can be really excited about saying, you're doing an exposure on the behavior. I'm doing an exposure on the emotion as well as the behavior.
Yeah.
Right.
That is really interesting. Wow. Are you intrigued, family? I'm intrigued and I'm curious to learn more. And so let's talk about this. So you have your new book, The Upside of OCD. And again, new book, because yes, this isn't his only book. And one of the things I'm just thinking about, especially within our collegial field here, there are a lot of books, good books, about OCD. And so I can see that you have a different approach to it, but what did you really want to communicate? What was kind of your goal going into this book and presenting another vantage point?
Yeah, you know, two things, really. So speaking to those of you who have watched people struggle and suffer from OCD, I wanted to write more to the heart of the person who has OCD. What's going on inside for them emotionally? What kind of deep sensitivity do they have that people often miss? What kind of creativity do they show that people only see when it's tormenting them? So I really wanted to show more of the person as well as the disorder. But my kind of new angle is that I think a person who has these qualities develops OCD. And I think we tend to focus when the disorder is already flourished and forget about these really interesting, kind of beautiful characteristics of a person who will later develop OCD. And so to me, I wanted to reclaim this heart. Because I think people with OCD actually have an enormous heart. Like if the Grinch has like a heart that's like way too small, a person with OCD has a heart that's way too big. And it's often so big for others and not big enough for the self.
Right.
And so even if you think about cognitive behavioral therapy, does a wonderful job of focusing on how these thought spirals happen and how we can kind of interrupt them and disrupt them and move beyond them. But it doesn't talk enough about the heart and the emotions. It often talks about emotions as resulting from getting in check with that. But I just wanted to come from the heart first.
Yeah. It is interesting because a lot of times, and for people that are not as familiar with the exposure model, and you keep hearing exposure, I'm sure you can extrapolate, oh, you're exposing yourself to something and that sounds distressing. OCD is distressing, right? And so a lot of times those feelings drive different compulsive or avoidant behaviors. And so in more of a traditional ERP model, part of the learning is no matter what the basis for that distress is, you don't have to respond to that, right? And so it almost is, it's very counter to starting with the heart first, because the point is that we can live our life anyway, whether we're distressed or not, and that, you know, we can get these false alarms going off about the distress if we learn through the therapy that we can face these different challenges, live our best lives. Often that distress dissipates, but they're very much like move towards the distress. And there may be some moving towards the distress when you're starting with the heart, but the heart is kind of a secondary effect in terms of how that piece can resolve. And so you're wanting to start at the core of the person's emotions and feelings, it sounds like. So would you say that's part of the upside of OCD? Or what do you mean when you talk about the upside of OCD?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I quote, you know, the great saying from Blaise Pascal, which is like, the heart has reasons of which reasons nourish nothing. So there's a tremendous amount of wisdom in our feelings. There's a tremendous amount of depth and nuance and creativity. And yes, that is exactly what the upside is, because people with OCD, and research has shown this, people with OCD are extremely empathetic, extremely generous with that heart of theirs, so much so that it often then leads them to worry and ruminate, and particularly around the loss of somebody, the harm of somebody, the harm of themselves. Like, think about all the different themes that OCD hits. It's the, am I in the right relationship or is that going to be destroyed? It's all about connecting and potentially losing. And so I actually wanted to look at OCD in a similar way that, let's say, Susan Cain looks at introverts or Elaine Aron looks at highly sensitive people. I think that people with OCD have a specialized sensitivity, a specialized emotional sensitivity, an emotional sixth sense. They pick up on them. They pick up it very quickly.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to figure out what to do with that. See, the beautiful thing about therapy, I think, is that it gives us, we're empathy detectives as therapists. Mm-hmm. We try to understand what is a person feeling and thinking, and how can we help them put it into form so that they can see it and then express it and contain it. And people with OCD, I think, picking up so much emotion in the environment, and then it can feel out of control. They don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's such a more generous way of looking at people with OCD, because if you start from that premise, you're like, oh, it doesn't start out as a problem. It starts out as a gift, right? In other words, to be able to be so tuned in, to be able to be so aware, isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Right.
It's a bad thing if I don't know what to do with it, and I don't have anybody who can explain it.
Yeah.
And the other thing that people with OCD have is that heart is connected to then a very imaginative mind.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
A very creative, what-if case scenario, worst case scenario kind of mind. But that is also the capacity to try and notice. Again, I call people with OCD nuance noticers. Mm-hmm. Notice everything. I remember my son has this sensitivity. He's 6 years old. And I remember we went to his preschool parent-teacher conference.
Yeah. We know those, don't we, fam?
Yeah. You know, your son, so cute. He's so sweet. He's smart. But nothing gets by him.
Right.
And I thought, and nothing gets by him. He's a nuance noticer. He's always been very sensitive.
Yeah.
So I want to, the reason I called the book Flipping the Script, when I say flip the script to reclaim your life, is because I want to flip the script and see these beautiful attributes of the personality that develops OCD.
Yeah.
That people with OCD are kind, they're warm. And I liken it to having almost these sparks of feeling and sparks of imagination. And when those sparks are well tended to and nurtured, they can warm up the whole house and they can light up the city.
Yeah.
Right. But when they're not tended to, they end up causing your house to go on fire, and the five-alarm fire that brings out is often when treatment starts.
Right.
And I wanted to start it when we could take these beautiful sparks and make sure they have a nice fireplace and to really enjoy and appreciate the goodness, the light and the heat of it.
Yeah, I like the analogy of a fire, because a fire, A, can have very functional use, and it can also be warm and cozy and beautiful and kind of set a fun ambiance, or it can be destructive and it can take lives. And so it's not that fire itself is inherently bad, but it's knowing how to tame the fire, knowing how to contain the fire, knowing how to properly manage it toward the end when embers are the only thing aglow, and knowing what embers mean. And again, mm-hmm. even taking care with the embers. And so I like that analogy a lot. It's interesting, and I don't know how familiar you are with inference-based CBT. Are you familiar?
Yeah, I'm getting to become more familiar with it, and it's brilliant.
Yeah, I really like it. And so we call that ICBT for short. If you hear that, fam, then that's what I'm talking about. Inference-based CBT isn't going from a feelings perspective as much as a reasoning perspective. But again, you can see how feelings are going to be in the cauldron based on how you're reasoning a situation, if you're estimating threat, if you're estimating harm. And part of the beauty in that treatment model, too, is also relearning. Because in non-obsessional areas, actually, we have learned and do execute this well, but relearning how to trust ourselves where there's these hot, fiery embers or a blazing fire, right? And so it sounds like your approach is a little bit of a different take, starting with the fire and the heat of that and the magnitude of that and going from there. Would that be a fair analysis?
Yeah.
If I'm off, reposition, that's totally fine.
No, that's a beautiful one. And I loved your pulling the metaphor together with the cauldron, which, you know, this stuff feels wild, right? It feels scary. I as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, the great myth of Prometheus stealing the fire from the gods. I think for people with OCD, are young children who are aware and steal the fire early, but they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And of course it burns them up. I also sometimes jokingly refer to them as Max from Where the Wild Things Are. Remember how Max is really wild and he says, I'll eat you up, but I think he really wants to eat up the world and enjoy it. And not knowing how to tame that fire, that wildness. But of course, what I love about that story is that it's because he's excited. He has enthusiasm, which means to be possessed by the gods. Enthusiasm, right?
Yeah.
To have that kind of fire. And he goes to the place of the wild things where he can find a way to harness that,
yeah,
along with being civilized. And I think people with OCD have a hard time being able to hold on to that wildness and to carry their mischief and their morals too. Because we're very moral people, because we're very empathetic. How could you not be moral if you're empathetic?
Yeah.
But how do you carry that wildness of the fire as well? And how do you harness that? And the reason I think fire is such a beautiful analogy for it is, like you said, not only is it creative, it's so dynamic.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to share with this book, is the fire, the beautiful fire, and also that same beautiful fire can destroy us if we don't have the proper support and mentoring with how to use it.
Yeah.
And so I think this is something that I wanted to add to the dialogue out there. As you said about ICBT, which I do think is a brilliant addition, they're doing wonderful work with it, I think. And I think you're right. I think actually they talk a lot about reasoning and trusting, or relearning the trust of mm-hmm. your own instincts and your own feelings and your own thought process. But I think actually it's as much about feeling as any.
Yeah. Oh, so interesting. I think this is already a very interesting conversation, and we're just getting started. And so in terms of if people are going to grab a copy of the book, I know that you have a number of takeaways for different people, and not just for people with OCD, although you have a special heart for them, as you were just noting, but also what you want the community and just the general population to understand. So why don't we start with people that have OCD, OCD warriors, or maybe for family members that are surrounding them and going, gosh, I don't know what to do. And none of us are fire tamers. We don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And feeling absorbed by the heat. What are some practical takeaways that you feel the book can offer their way?
I have a radically hopeful approach to OCD, right? Mm-hmm. I call it a radically hopeful approach to OCD because within the upside, is not just the healing for all the downsides. It's rediscovering all this gold that is within you. I think something that's good for OCD sufferers as well as people like family members or significant others is to notice that it's difficult for someone with OCD to be with their bad selves. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be with the sides that feel wrong or bad, right? It's hard to be with maybe anger too much or jealousy or even self-interest or selfishness. And by the way, I said selfishness right next to it because even healthy self-interest can be mislabeled as selfishness by someone who has OCD. And so for a person with OCD, it's helpful for them to have more playful permission to just try on those sides and know that it's safe. It's also good for those around them to help them to try on those sides.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes people, I don't think people do this intentionally, maliciously, or even consciously. I think sometimes they can over-rely on the person with OCD's empathy. And then when the person with OCD is not being as open to that other person's position, they get upset at them. So what does this teach the person with OCD? It's bad to have my own self-interest and my own difference of opinion.
Yeah.
That might hurt things.
Michael, can I pause you there for a moment and also bring in this intersection for neurodivergent folks? Because I'm just thinking, I'm a mom of autistic children. And you were mentioning even for highly sensitive people, like, how do we kind of hold these emotions? And sometimes people have felt like, actually, I've received feedback maybe over the majority of my life that I need to respond a certain way. And if I'm responding this way, it's weird. And I have to work really hard at responding in this particular way. And so in terms of feeling an ability and permission, I'm just thinking particularly for our autistic OCD warriors, like, what a challenge this can be. And I wonder, I don't know if your book addresses that intersection at all, but it just came to mind.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I reference Greta Thunberg in the book at one point because she has that combination. She talks about that combination of OCD and autism. And I had no idea that, you know, OCD was part of her diagnostic picture. And I think there's a lot of overlap in this stuff about sensitivities. Right. Because you're talking about emotional sensitivity, you're talking about sensitivity of other kinds of sensory stuff. There's an overlap with the high sensitivity. So again, I think what's most important is mapping with empathy the personal world of that specific OCD sufferer. And if that includes a side order of whatever, that's important for deepening the empathy because a person with OCD needs more empathy for the self.
So I'm wondering if part of this is allowing and taking in and giving room to the blooming of all the different feelings and experiences, would your conceptualization of OCD be more egocentric, or do you still see it as egodystonic with some overlap? And before I have you answer that, I will just explain real quickly, anybody joining us, egocentric, short, dirty definition, it does the job. It's not like the textbook definition, but egocentric, more in sync with your values, egodystonic, far from who you would ever imagine yourself to be, very distressing, incongruent position. And so what would you say about that? Because as I'm listening to it, I'm just thinking, well, that almost sounds like, you know, again, you're framing the beauty that can be found in it. Would it be more egocentric then?
It's a great question. So I think of OCD as both an enemy and a friend, as a frenemy.
A frenemy, yes.
And the funny thing is, I'll add to what you're saying, most people, one of the reasons that OCD is such a tricky and persnickety disorder is that I would say probably 99% of people with OCD, it's ego dystonic, which means that they don't like that they, let's say, obsess about this or have to do their compulsions. And they sort of know that I really don't want to be doing this. This is not consistent with who I am in my heart, but I feel like I must. And if I don't, I feel like something awful is going to happen to me or somebody that I love, or my world is going to fall apart.
Right.
And so in that way, it's an enemy because it makes you do things that you don't really want to do. It makes you repeat things that you really wish you could stop, which is so different, let's say, than somebody who has obsessive compulsive personality disorder, who really just thinks this is the right way to do things. And if only the rest of the world saw the wisdom of my ways, they would do it too, which is much more ego symptomatic.
Right.
But here's the nuance that I like to throw in the picture, which sort of you see a little bit in terms of internal family systems, which is a therapy approach that's not necessarily used for OCD per se, although it's been tried now. But it's the idea of learning about different sides of self.
The parts, yeah.
The parts of self and befriending them, and especially befriending the parts. I like jokingly saying, when people come to therapy with me, I jokingly say, listen, it's like we have this table set before us, and we're going to have a conversation. And we're going to invite this side and that side. And we're going to be really curious about the side that talks the most. And we're going to be curious about the side that talks the least. But we're going to be even more curious about the sides that aren't even invited or allowed at the table. Those are the sides that are often causing a lot of trouble, but they have not been listened to.
Yeah.
And often those sides come out in symptoms.
Right.
And the things that bother us, the things that really hurt us.
And our catalyst, kind of a gasoline to the fire, right? You know, what really feels out of control. But I like that idea of thinking about the parts that even in therapy, you would go, I don't know if I could bring. I fear that.
Yeah, I don't know if I could bring my selfish side to the table because that feels wrong. I don't know if I could bring my angry side to the table, my jealous side. Isn't that wrong? Isn't that, you know, inconsiderate of me to be jealous of somebody else's? Whatever.
Yeah.
So again, empathy, as we say in politics, empathy isn't necessarily endorsing the position. It's understanding it and having curiosity and compassion about it so that it tells a fuller story.
Yeah.
So the reason that I say that sometimes OCD is like a friend is because I have this not so strange take. It's a borrowing, really. It's a really taking from psychodynamic thought. That sometimes, often, OCD is a strange messenger that is trying to tell you something in the most extreme and exaggerated, painful way. And while it is banging you over the head with it, it's what I call a thank you, asshole moment. Thank you for teaching me something, but you've also been an asshole. And OCD can be a real asshole because it will really torment us. But I also think if you can look a little bit closer, OCD sometimes is also trying to show you something that you're missing. And I'll give you a quick example. So I once had this client when I was in training. So lovely. She worked for a nonprofit. She was the most altruistic person I'd ever met. She was just sweet, charming. And one day she told me, Mike, I just can't get this obsession out of my head. I'm worried that I have brain damage. And she just kept on. And she was like, starting to stress about it, asking questions. I'm checking this, and I've been, you know, re-looking online. And she told me the story, and I said to her, "Let's just talk about what was going on for you when you started to notice this obsession started to hit." And as she told me, I go into depth on the story in the book. She told me that a colleague of hers that she's had known very well, they were joking around and playfully hit her. She didn't like it, and it felt like a cross the line. But she was too nice to say anything. She could never say anything. That would be aggressive in her book. And I noticed that her obsession started to come up right after this. But I thought, huh, isn't that interesting? Your obsession is trying to provide a boundary for you where you felt like you couldn't have a voice. And what is it signaling? Something very precious to me is being taken away. What's the most important thing in the world? The brain is pretty important, right? Now, as soon as we talked about it from the context of befriending that part of a message, we realized the message was an exaggeration for her to turn up the volume so she'd be listening.
Yeah.
And as soon as we started to talk about that, it opened up and the obsession started to melt because we were looking at the context. Now, I know that, by the way, for people listening out there, people who practice exposure response prevention often talk about the big taboo of talking about content.
Yeah.
Get very concerned about talking about content of your obsessions because they get worried. And now you're going to go down the rabbit hole and explore all sorts of things.
And ruminate.
So,
and ruminate.
And so for those of them who are listening and those of you who are confused, my simple takeaway is context matters. I'm looking at the context of when and how this obsession developed to understand its potential relationship and its possibility of trying to be a messenger to you. And if we can decode the message, my little mantra in the book is that OCD will distract the hell out of you while trying to focus you. That's a paradox. And as you know from now talking to me now, that I'm all about paradox and I'm all about both. And
yeah.
And so OCD can be an enemy, a jerk, a bully, an asshole. And it can also be trying to say, hey, buddy, you're not looking at something as a friend would.
Yeah, it makes me think, and you said you have a 6-year-old. I have a 7, 8, and newly minted 11-year-old. And it makes me think of back in my birth to 5 days in that specialty, we would talk about how things that would stereotypically be classified as a meltdown or someone having a fit was actually communication, right? You know,
yes.
We needed to
yes.
be curious and wonder aloud together about what is being communicated here. And so it made me think of that a little bit when you were saying, you know, it's screaming at you and it may be bullying and you may not like at all this experience. But what is the function of that? There's still a meaning, and function's probably the word that I typically plug in there versus context. But
yes.
what is the meaning of this? And, you know, from an inference-based CBT perspective, too, we look and say, you know, context of the story makes a lot of sense, but we have to have direct evidence that that story is actually happening here and now. And so a big key feature in ICBT is sorting out what is living purely in the imagination versus what we have context and direct evidence and internal sense data for in the here and now. But when we started the conversation today, you were talking about the imagination in a more positive light. And I agree that imagination can be an absolutely beautiful thing. It also can be a terrifying thing, right? As all us OCD people with lived experience know, and you as family members know, like it can be so cruel. But if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like you're embracing that imagination in a different way. And this is part of the work with the fire, if you will, to rein in, and you wouldn't say imagination equals bad.
No, and I love what you said. And I think bringing it back to children is exactly on point. Because let me add to that in a way that almost is important if you think about the neuroscience of how we're built and also even the evidence. Notice our feelings are much more operative in the first 6, 7, 8 years of life, especially the first 5, right? Our right brain is much more developed than our left brain as well as our frontal cortex for a reason.
Yeah.
Because we actually grow so much more by having our feeling lead the way. We evolved as a species in this beautiful way mm-hmm. to have parents who protect us with their developed logic, but that we benefit from using this rich feeling world, this rich imagination world to make these quantum leaps of development.
Yeah.
So the reason why I think that feelings come first is not because I'm just a poet, which I love feelings, but it's also because scientifically feelings always come first. And I think if I were to gently critique CBT treatments, is that I think they presume that feelings come second after a thinking process intervenes. And I do think that feeling comes second as well, but I think feeling is also primary.
Right.
And I wanted to restore the fact that the deep feeling, the deep imaginative world is there first. And we can bridge that with the logical, rational world that we know and love so much and makes us feel a sense of order and control. And we are, as Leonardo da Vinci captured in that beautiful image of Vitruvian Man, we are a round peg in a square hole. Logic and emotion are the most interesting and contradictory and complementary things. That is how we're built. And my point in writing this is to say that thinking and feeling can be better integrated for those people who have OCD. And I think that we spend a lot of time in the sort of third eye chakra, the wisdom chakra, rather than the heart chakra for OCD. But the cool thing is they could be so easily blended. And I think I'm really excited about, obviously I'm excited about the work that I'm doing, but I'm also excited about ICBT for doing that. I'm excited for ERP for trying to look further with how can we deepen exposures and also how can we think about them not just about behavior? I think we should use anything and everything that we have at our disposal to be more fully human or myths. And I think OCD is a really interesting test case. I don't think there's any coincidence that Freud was fascinated by it. Because when you look at OCD, you have the quintessential conflicts of being human. How do I love so much and how can I be aware of how much I will lose? How can I care for others and have my self-interest? How can I have my own power and yet be moral and thoughtful?
Yeah.
These are the existential questions. These are the Hamlet to be or not to be questions that we all ask ourselves, but the person with OCD feels that early and intensely.
Right.
And so coming back to the feeling, you know how we talk about evidence base in treating OCD? I want us to look a little bit more at the evidence base for how much feelings matter.
Yeah.
And how much context or function matters. Because sometimes, you know, there have been some approaches to OCD that says they quote Hamlet from another place. Actually, they quote Macbeth. They quote Macbeth and say, OCD is nothing but sound and fury, signifying that. Because they say, listen, your OCD is really just meaningless, random, trying to throw stuff at you. And if you can just get past that, you will be better. But then it also says, what's meaning, right?
And Michael, I would say, you know, one of the things, even when I started learning ICBT, that was appealing to me was I felt like we can't have it both ways. We can't say OCD is batting 300 on hitting all our values, but it's meaningless. Like, how does that randomized, like, power shot working?
That's a really interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. And so learning that there is a more of a rhyme to the reason is interesting. And, you know, in ICBT, it's all about looking at that reasoning. I think what scares people, and I'm not saying this is like the official position or anything, but I think what scares people is that feelings are so subjective, not only across people, but within people. You know, what my anger might look like in one context is going to be different than maybe in another context, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so it feels very variable, and science and evidence-based practice in particular likes neat boxes. It likes the little petri dish. And it
likes the randomized clinical trials.
Yes, or RCTs, if you've ever heard that. Yeah. And so in terms of the study and for the testing, we do need to be able to limit variables and go, it was because of this or because of that. But at the same time, we don't all fit in little petri dishes. Nobody just fits in a little petri dish. And so it becomes very challenging when you take something looking at the science of feelings that are so varied across people and within people. And I think that variability scares people. And I could be wrong about that, but in just thinking.
I think it's totally right. No, I think that's totally right. I think it's a really important point. And I think, you know, it's so funny. My first book was written for therapists, and it was looking at how therapists are like artists, and those who do therapy really well are like artists. And there's been interesting studies on what are called super shrinks. And super shrinks are those who have like a 10 times more effective rate than your average therapist. And when they look closer at these super shrinks, what do they find? They were extremely responsive and changeable. They could be a different therapist from session to session because they were able to not only empathize with the feeling, but then zero in and talk about what that feeling was saying about what the problem was and how to solve it. That is the ingenuity of being human. And you're right, it is sometimes difficult to quantify and measure that. But a young Freud was told by the great Jean Charcot, because, you know, Freud loved to theorize, and he always talked about theory.
He did enjoy a good theory.
And so he said, I imagine him kind of patting him on the head and saying, my young man, theory is good, but it doesn't prevent things from existing. Feelings exist, the complexity and nuance of this exists. And we measure it and capture it is another question.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it isn't happening.
Right. Or that treating it and improving the management of it, just like we would a fire, wouldn't improve things, right? Just
right.
Because
yeah.
It's harder to quantify, yeah.
So if you think about it another way, just to give you a science-y example for the people who need to see a more concrete example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just because Gregor Mendel didn't actually know what the scientific proof was for the gene or genes, he still was able to intuit and induce from his studies a simple monk of seeing he foresaw stuff that we would later learn was the blueprint for life. And artists do this too. I mean, Freud has a quote, which we think is rather apocryphal. He says, "Everywhere I've been, I find the poet has been there before me." Mm-hmm. Because if you want to understand memory, you didn't have to read the neuroscientist, read Marcel Proust. He understood memory better than anybody in the 19th century. Many things that seemingly don't have evidence yet are captured. They're lived. They're experienced.
Right.
And so the reason that I say is, yes, I think we should always be trying to figure out how to be more specific and precise about how we measure things, but we also shouldn't put blinders on to limiting what else is possible just because we don't see it on our radar screen.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, actually, just even thinking about Dean McKay, or thinking about here in the States, the American Psychological Association, how they conceptualize things and what goes into being an EST.
Empirically supported treatment.
Perhaps. Yes, empirically supported treatment. And this idea of a three-legged stool, and one of the legs of that stool that is going to bring balance, it's going to bring structural integrity to that research practice, is your person's expertise and their agency. And so I like what you're saying about, too, about therapists almost as artists and being creative. And as we know, OCD folks are some of the most creative people ever.
Oh, my gosh.
And I'm not just, like, tooting my own horn since I have a...
No, it's true.
But they are. They're
very creative. It's true, though.
Right?
We can talk about some of the many. Yeah.
Yes. But what's interesting to me is sometimes that gets downplayed, or, you know what, I don't want to be pejorative, but to me it feels... We'll use the F word because that's the word of the day. It feels downplayed. The expertise and the nuancing, the care that clinicians bring to a situation, and the creativity and the artistry, similar to and parallel to, it sounds like, what the lived experience person is bringing to their OCD as well. And so it's one of the reasons why, and maybe you've seen a TikTok or a reel to this effect, but I get picked up in all the psych algorithms anyway. And so I'll see people trying to do therapy on themselves with ChatGPT, and it's why ChatGPT is not a great therapist, right? Because it can pull in a second. It can pull from all the shoulds and how this could construct. But what it misses is that human element that understands the nuancing. Another analogy I use sometimes with the family here, but for newer family joining us, and I'm going to let my Midwest show here, but it's kind of like making a jelly. You can have the ingredients for jelly and it should make, but so many people will try that recipe and they'll go, it's not setting correctly. I followed the instructions. I did everything right. Why isn't this turning out? And it's because there is nuancing and there is understanding to how the gelatin's going to set and when to add and what temperatures and really the science of it as well. And so it does take a skilled person that, in my opinion, is humble and able to also be creative and realize that, you know, because we don't all live in these petri dishes, some creativity to understand how this is functioning or the context, like you were saying, is really, really important.
And that's also where we make a lot of the innovations, right?
Yeah.
There's a great writer, Matthew Syed. He wrote a book called Rebel Ideas. And he talks about, like, rebel ideas often happen and people think they're totally stupid. Like the guy who brought luggage suitcase to somebody and said, hey, why don't you put wheels on this? And they were like, that's crazy.
That's a great cut.
Crazy.
That's a great cut.
Right. So, but the thing is, and to your point of nuance, I just wanted to, I was looking up the etymology of the word nuance when I was writing the book, because I talk a lot about nuance in the book. I'm like, what is this nuance, right? Where does it come from? And it comes from the French word nuage, which clouds, right? Because if you think about clouds, they have all this depth and dimension to them, and they're constantly changeable. But then I thought the paradox is when you talk about something being cloudy, it's like you can't really see it.
Yeah.
And so the very thing, nuance, allows the contradiction to be there.
Yeah.
And I think that it's hard for not only those of us in science, but I think as a culture, it's hard for us to stay with the nuance because it's slippery. It is very changeable. And I I happen to think, I think I stole this from somewhere, but I jokingly say it's my own definition, so who knows? I think creativity, psychological creativity, is the art of staying the same while changing, or the art of changing while staying the same. That's the brilliant thing for all of us. And that's difficult, and that's what nuance allows you to do, but there's an art to it. There's a science to it, and there's an art to it. So Darwin is a great example of someone who struggled with OCD, or OCD symptoms.
Darwin was a big
reassurance seeker. There are some stories of him in the middle of the night going to a neighbor to make sure he didn't say something that was hurtful, right? He worried about the death of his children. He doubted even his own theories. It took him years to publish it. But we don't talk about that aspect of this guy, right? We don't talk about that. We talk about, well, his brilliance and all this other stuff. But that brilliance came from having such an imaginative, inquisitive mind to think about all sorts of permutations. And they would have said he had no evidence base either.
Yeah.
So I think it's important for us to be humble about evidence base is important because we obviously don't want to just be doing something that's not vetted.
Yeah.
Right. Of course. And something that's maybe potentially destructive or not helpful. But I also think it's important for us to have a little bit of modesty about how much we really know about what we're doing here. And I think the hopeful part of that is that there's so much more that we can do if we take some more risks in that way.
Yeah.
And I think the best people, that's the reason why I'm excited to be here, is I think the best people who know that is those who have it in their heart and know it in their bones of what it is like to live with this. And those who are around them.
And I was going to say, and the family around them, and even in your own story with your mother having contamination OCD, you were in the arena. Sometimes for family members, I feel like those of us with lived experience, and I have other family members, so I know this from a family member perspective too. Sometimes it's hard to really validate how hard it can be for us as well, because we have so much empathy for the pain that our loved one is going through, and we're trying to get them help. Like, most people here aren't reaching out because they're thinking, I need support. Not all y'all. Okay. But some of y'all will be like, wait, that's not me. But usually they're not reaching out just going, I need support. They're reaching out going, how can I better love my loved one? Mm-hmm. And what they find, at least I hope we find, is the best way you can love your loved one is to love yourself and take care of yourself and learn in those ways, because you're already doing a fantastic job loving your loved ones. Are there little things we can do that can help us be able to love our person and not just infuse that into OCD? OCD tries to hijack that a lot. But a lot of people come and find this community because they're like, gosh, this is really hard. This is creating a dynamic in our family. I want to know how I can do better. I feel badly. Sometimes I'm learning I'm a part of the accommodation that's made OCD have strength and bigger teeth. And so there's a lot of guilt, and sometimes there's shame, and there's a lot of those different feelings. But everyone is in the arena in this. This is affecting the entire family system. And you're right. The people with lived experience, certainly no one knows it better than them, but the family members too, they are in the arena, whether they want to be or not. They are in the arena because this affects relationships.
Which is exactly why I wanted to share these other elements of it. Because I think if you can understand a little bit more from the inside out, it's not just what OCD feels like, but what it's trying to do for you and do to you.
Yeah.
I think it gives you more tools to be able to say, we can find a new creative path with this. We can find a new creative path with this to be more with your feelings, to be more with your thoughts, and also to be more with your thoughts that don't just run away. Because people with OCD go to the negative very quickly, and they're simplistic too, because they tend to notice both sides of the coin.
Yeah.
And if you notice both sides of the coin, you don't always have people saying, oh, I could see both sides. They say, wait, pick a side. And yeah. There's a person then feels like, oh, it must be negative. So I'm going to go to the negative side because at least I'm sure, right? Then I'll be safest. But if we go to the nuance, then we allow us to say, you know, it is funny that you can both really love the person that is closest to you and really hate them. You could really love your parent, but really sometimes really get angry at them or feel really hurt by them. That's not strange.
Right.
That's really human.
Right.
But you feel it more keenly because you notice that. And the other thing that I think I've been alluding to throughout our conversation is the deep existential sensitivity of those with OCD. I think of people with OCD as having an existential sensibility from when they're very young without any existentialist philosophers to give them any words for it. And if you think about it, every iteration of OCD is about death and loss, right? The loss of a person that I love, the loss of myself, the loss of a relationship, the loss of a prized part of my identity. All of it centers around death and chaos and the fear that you can't live with that and live in life.
Yeah. I'm curious because you said the magic word in terms of when you were talking about the coin flip. And if I have to pick a side, I'm going to go here because I'd be more sure. And so that brings up to the topic of certainty. A lot of times, the conversation, particularly when we're looking at it from a behavioral model, is this, whether it's tolerance or difficulty accepting uncertainty, right?
Right.
ICBT is less on that. And in fact, we can have functional certainties in a lot of things.
Yes, right? That's very interesting.
But I'm curious, what do you see certainty's role if feelings is the basis that we're approaching OCD from?
Yeah, it's a really interesting conundrum there. It's a really interesting puzzle because you're right. There's some part of being with uncertainty that's healthy, and there's some part of it, like ICBT says, that, wait, why should I have to tolerate so much of that? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right. So, in that example with the brain damage obsession, right, it's a good example of like one person would take that treatment and say, let's just tolerate the uncertainty that you have been hurt and that you could get brain damage, right? They might go down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the person with ICBT would say, wait, why should she have to live with that fear over her head, literally and metaphorically, all the time, right? That seems like way too much. Like, that's terrible to have to live with, right?
Well, and ICBT would say that's not the basis for it when it considers it within the realm of inferential confusion. But
yeah, that's not the basis of why it happened in the first place.
Right,
and so it's not really the real answer in a way to resolving it. And that's where I would agree with that, because I think that's where I think having some uncertainty, the uncertainty that's the curious, creative uncertainty of like, I wonder what else I'm missing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of it could be reason. Oh, wait, I didn't think about that. But some of it could be healthy imagination. Huh. Isn't that interesting that my psyche would talk about me getting brain damage after I was angry that somebody was getting too close to me in my body?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really speaking my thoughts. Isn't that brilliant? Never thought of it that way. So it's sort of like allowing yourself to be more of a creative thinker there. It's not just going down the rabbit hole of this is all bad. This is an opportunity. Remember, you know, Bob Ross, the painter, used to say everything is a happy accident. The beautiful thing is that we sometimes don't allow these to be happy accidents and open to that. That's what the creative person does. And I think people with OCD are really open to a lot of creativity.
Yeah.
But not kind of being mentored how to lean into that even more fully. Yeah. Right. So what you were saying about uncertainty and certainty is too much certainty is perfection, which is problematic. Even a creative person doesn't really want perfection. They don't expect to have the perfect poem or the perfect painting or the perfect song. It is a real product, so it must be limited. It has to be within the frame.
Right.
But does it have some transcendent quality that you can feel proud of? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great phrase by the poet John Keats, who he has this lovely term called negative capability. And negative capability is the ability to not go for the quick and easy answer and not to think that reason alone will solve it. It's to kind of allow yourself to be with things in a lot of different dimensions. That's what nuance is about. That kind of uncertainty is good.
Right.
Uncertainty that is harrowing, throwing daggers at you, doubting and worrying and only thinking the world is going to end, you're at fault, and everything is terrible. That's not healthy uncertainty. That's not only not functional, it's not compassionate, it's not fair. So I think there's a mix, and there's a beautiful story of the Buddha who's sitting under the Bodhi tree meditating, and he's about to attain enlightenment. And just as he's about to reach this high plane of existence, Mara, the god of destruction, decides to mess with him and throws all sorts of weapons. I like to think of it as daggers, but it was all sorts of weapons. Mm-hmm. And of course, most people would have completely gotten thrown out of their meditation and really believed all this stuff. But the Buddha, as an exemplar for people with OCD, stayed through his meditation, trusting that something bigger and deeper that he was tapping into, and those daggers become lotus blossoms. Transforming the uncertainty of doubt and fear and death into lotus blossoms, that I'm all for.
Yeah. Well, and if we think about the distress our loved ones with OCD are battling, yeah, it's really hard for so many people, the family members, the lived experience people themselves, to imagine lotus blossoms being possible in the midst of that, right? You know, it's really interesting. In December, my husband had his annual company holiday party, and we went and flew to it. It was a nice time, but I was sitting with one of the CEO's brothers, and the CEO is actually a friend of my husband's that they've worked together over the years, and a couple of the brothers all work on different positions in the company, usually mostly all C-level, and they're all very, very ambitious entrepreneurs. And so somebody at our table when we were having dinner was asking, how is it that all of you and your family are so driven? And like, isn't that exhausting? How do you pursue being an entrepreneur that just goes? And as he was talking and describing the evaluation of risk and facing that and all of the different things, I couldn't help but to think, he's talking about his ability to embrace uncertainty or to face uncertainty and have it be data versus direction. And it's not to say entrepreneurs can't have OCD and feel very distressed about things, but it became a point of conversation that he and I got into because I said, what you're talking about is being able to utilize the uncertainty instead of fear it and kind of sail along in the uncertainty for whatever your business goals, et cetera, are. And he was like, absolutely, I would agree. Entrepreneurship is all about this uncertainty. And I was like, in the field where I work, uncertainty gets a very, very bad rap. And in the world, many of us, well, you don't have to have OCD. You go, oh gosh, even if it was a bad answer, if I just know, I could handle this a little better. Like, the world is always marketing products. Society's always saying, if you just do this, you could be happy. Because we want some certainty that we can achieve that, that we can make that. Even he was talking about, this was interesting, even as America formed as a country of immigrants, everybody who ended up immigrating, immigrated why? Because they were in search of something more, or they were coming with their family who was in search of something more, right? And so even the needlework of our country is based on this curiosity. And in OCD, that curiosity can get pathologized, right?
And it can get co-opted, right? It can get co-opted, right, by the stuff. And I think it's a really beautiful point that as a culture and a society, we sometimes give uncertainty a bad name. One of the books that I read, and the person who endorsed the book, is her name, Maggie Jackson, has a beautiful book called Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. And she looks at all these different interesting areas in science and technology and business and the arts and politics where we can lean into uncertainty to enhance not only our wisdom, but our sense of emotional connection to things. And I think it's really important that that's what I think the Buddha was also trying to show, is that you might be able to find even more in the thing that seems to be just that. And again, that's coming back to the nuance. Whether it's the entrepreneur or the creative artists, they see the risk, but they also see the possibility. Mm-hmm. And they know that risk and possibility are always part of any kind of creative endangerment. And there's even been studies that show that some of these people who are big venture capitalists, they're actually more risk averse than you would realize. They're just smarter about it. Mm-hmm. So the people who are actually really successful in this, they do think about the consequences.
Yeah,
they aren't just saying, I am just willy-nilly just accepting and tolerating complete uncertainty.
Right.
But they actually explore all these different angles so then they can leverage that.
And it's like taming that fire.
It's taking the fire.
Original analogy that we were using with OCD, if you know how, then it doesn't have to be the scary thing. It doesn't mean you won't ever get burned. You can still get burned. But yeah,
it's about working with that and appreciating it. And, you know, it's funny, I referenced a bunch of different celebrities struggled with OCD. And some of them that I think of, like the musician and producer Jack Antonoff, is a great example of someone who, like, the nuance at which he will produce and listen to these nuances in the music clearly comes from this sensibility of sensitivity. The same when you read a novel by John Green, you know, who's discussed his own OCD background.
He is from Indiana. I just thought it was shown up.
Oh, there you go. Indianapolis is featured in Turtles All the Way Down. Yeah,
that's right.
And I hope one day he reads the book, because there's so many beautiful elements of the depth and creativity of the person who later develops OCD. So my role here was not to glamorize OCD. OCD, like I say in the beginning of the book, is a circle of hell that's reserved for people who are the least deserving of being there.
Right.
There's nothing glamorous about when OCD hits and how it does it. It's Kafka-esque. It's torture. But the fire, the healthy fire that comes before OCD, these healthy sparks that you can tap into that can actually help you heal your OCD and actually help you become bigger than your OCD and more yourself, that's what I do celebrate.
Yeah. One of the things I will tell clients, and I've said it on the podcast probably more times than I can remember, though I don't wish OCD upon anyone, one of the beautiful things is as you learn more and as you work through treatment, the opportunity you have to be able to say, okay, like, this is my brain braining and I can accept that, when most of the world can't. Most of the world is constantly trying to solve this issue. And when you take away problems to solve and you just realize, like, okay, this was, whether it's the boundary, as you were sharing with the brain example, the boundary trying to scream at you and you trying
to reconcile. Yeah, listen to me.
Right. The reasoning errors in ICBT, whether it's the learning that actually doing that response prevention can create new learning in the brain from an ERP perspective, whatever path you take. And one of the things Stuart Ralph and I talked about too is like forging these new paths. There are pathways that we know how to climb a mountain, but that doesn't mean we can't create new paths just because we already have some established paths.
You said something even more brilliant that I want to share with people, because you forgot it, which is that you said, you know, once upon a time we thought that going to the moon was impossible and that it seemed completely out of reach, but it wasn't because of the way we approached it. And I think the same goes for OCD treatment. And I've been reading about the moon landing recently because I was just inspired about it. And you know, you think these are guys were like the biggest like science tech guys, right? It turns out for Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin to land on the moon, they had to turn off the computer in those last few minutes because the computer was assuming they were going to land somewhere else. They had to improvise in the moment. They also had to ignore alarms going off. Talk about like OCD alarms going off.
Yeah.
Telling them that there was a real major problem. And Houston had to tell them, don't worry about it. It's fine. Keep on going.
Right.
And what they did then is they had only 30 seconds of fuel left when they actually landed.
Wow.
And so I want people to see that, you know, embracing also trusting your full instincts and figuring out how to be creative with this stuff is what all of us need to do.
Yeah.
And that's how getting to the moon was possible. And that's, I think, how, if you want to think of, whether you're thinking of conquering OCD as your metaphor, or whether you're thinking of understanding your OCD and finding a way to temper its challenging hard edges and befriending its messenger, whatever way you think about it, that is so important for being more of who you really are meant to be. And that, to me, is what the upside is all about.
Yeah, I really like that. An old cliche of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's like, because the baby is so precious. And I think
so precious.
So many times we're like, get the whole freaking bathroom out of here.
Yeah, get it out of here.
And again, when you're approaching it from a hair on fire standpoint, you're trying to survive in that. But to realize that a person's individual strengths, that there are no bad feelings, right? There are just...
And that your feelings are interacting with your thoughts. And so it makes sense that worries would come up when feelings are not being listened to. And it's also understandable that your thoughts are going to try and control things because thoughts can feel more perfect. Our bodies are limited. Our feelings are limited. They make us feel humble. Our thoughts make us feel stronger sometimes. And even if we drive ourselves crazy with them,
yeah,
it strangely feels like we're more in control. And that's where our imagination goes off the races, like you said, with ICBT. But then remember that imagination has this other side where it's generative. So I like talking about turning your what if scenarios into why not? Why not? Why can't I look at the full picture? Why can't I look more closely at what I'm feeling and thinking with more self-compassion, right?
Right.
With more creativity.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. And I get where this argument comes from, but I think some of the fear around that is that you're going to get involved in a compulsive cycle, right? Or mental compulsions, or get absorbed into that. But it has to be okay to have a look at what the content is, especially if the content is hitting value-driven areas, and go, this stirs up things for me, you know, and to be able to approach. It's interesting because before we started recording Family, I was listening to the Wicked soundtrack, and Defying Gravity was one of the songs, which I've always loved that musical, but I just happened to have it on. But as you were describing part of that, I started to even think of some of those lyrics from Defying Gravity in terms of being able to say, like, yeah, we don't have to be limited by, and again, these kind of check boxes of how does this fit in neatly here, but we can explore feelings and all, how we can be limitless. And it's, again, it's about the process of being able to know how to tame that fire. Not saying let the fire just take out 10,000 square feet. It's saying there's good to this fire. There's destruction to this fire. It's all about how we learn to engage, interact, reduce, die down that fire, all of that. And so understanding that is really building some of that self-compassion and empathy for self, which is so hard, right, family? Because I think so many people can say, I'm my own worst critic. Even if I don't have OCD, I'm going to give other people a pass and some grace on things that when I do it, even to that half of that level, I'm going to feel awful and shame and like I'm the worst person suddenly. Even though we would give, you know, our child, our spouse, our mother, sometimes, it depends, right? You know, family stuff gets complicated, I know, but we would give other people more grace than we give ourselves. So really, this is, the upside is partly just a word that kind of popped up, and you could tell me if it feels a little different than how you conceptualize it, but it's really learning to give yourself some of that grace.
I think it's exactly it. It reminds me of this wonderful poem by Derek Walcott, in which it's called Love After Love. And he says, you know, the time will come when with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at each other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself, right? Give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your own life. You know, that's what I think it's all about, that I think it's so important for those of us with OCD to support those with OCD, is to help them to appreciate that beauty.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, one of my frames of references, so not pitting against, but as I learned ICBT, I felt like this treatment is really a love letter to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can trust me. I've got this. This is good. I'm not this monster.
I actually think you make a really important point too within the field, is that I think if you look at ERP or exposure response prevention and ICBT, they're actually important because there's some parts that you really need to learn how to trust and get to know and trust that instinct and intuition. And there's some parts that are just out to get you. And that's the frenemy idea that I have. And it doesn't have to be a competition between which one wins out. They're both really operating. And I think the reason why ICBT is so important right now is because we haven't been given enough with a love letter to ourselves. That's exactly why I wrote the book about the upside, is because I think talking about the heart, talking about these other sides of it are so crucial. And we can trust that heart. We can trust that sensitivity for ourselves, that healthy creative imagination for ourselves. We can trust the fire when it's contained and in the right place. And then we also can also trust ourselves that when it's trying to throw those daggers at it, that it's not truly real. And to live in that paradox, I think, is to transcend what OCD is trying to do. But again, if your greatest tormentor is also your messenger, you say, like, remember that poem by Rumi, The Guest House? Every morning is a new arrival, a joy and illness. And each guest comes like messing up all of your furniture. But by the end of the poem, he says, but greet each guest like a guide from beyond. So the thing that disrupts you is also the thing that is there to instruct you.
Yeah.
And I think for those of us with OCD, if we can live in that paradox more, we'll bring all this together. And you will live not only through your OCD, but beyond your OCD.
Which kind of brings it back to that idea of IFS, which earlier Mike was referencing, internal family systems family. So IFS, we have alphabet soup all over in our treatment field. But yeah, of those parts, you know, these are all parts of you. And it kind of reminds me then of that analogy you said of having everyone come to the table, not just this side and that side, but all of the parts coming to the table and being able to work together and to integrate together versus having subterfuge from OCD or from a fire gone ablaze. And we're like, what the hell, you know?
Yeah. And isn't it nice to finally be able to sit comfortably with all of yourselves and to have a creative conversation?
Yeah. And I would say like comfort isn't the overall goal, but comfort feels really freeing, right? And I think
the liberation, I think, of really being able to hear and listen and then work collaboratively, do something creative and constructive out of that.
Yeah.
And even that, I think, is where you also find meaning and purpose, not just in your values, but also in really listening deeply to yourself. I think if there's anything as a therapist, I think we're in the business of is listening deeply. And I think if we can do that more for ourselves, and I think if those of your family members who are helping people with OCD is to help them listen in with more curiosity and compassion and empathy on all these sides, especially the difficult ones.
Yeah, well said. I really like that. So in our natural progression of the conversation, that all sprang from three practical takeaways. But, you know, one piece I would be remiss if we didn't include is the cultural significance, because I think it's really important. And so many evidence-based treatments feel like they're for thee, not for me, in terms of if you don't fit a certain profile, or a lot of the studies have been done in more kind of westernized regions or within certain race and ethnic groups, etc. And so I would love if we could address this piece for culture, the significance and the value that the upside can bring and the hope that it can bring in that conversation.
Yeah, I think what the upside does for the culture is I think it allows us to appreciate the amazing diversity within us that we all of us human beings grapple with, all of us seek to try and make sense of, try to feel our way through, think our way through. And I think it allows us to be even more sensitive to each other. If there's something that I think our culture is missing right now, it's a healthy level of empathy that can also tolerate the uncertainty and ambiguity of having differences. As a culture, we have a hard time balancing that with also our self-interest and our capacity to see the other. And I think that's what's at the heart of OCD. How do you live in a world that can be constantly changing with those things?
Yeah.
And so I think when you get closer to people with OCD and help them to see the nuance, because they do notice the nuance, we help the world notice the nuance. Mm-hmm. We help people to be more compassionate and more discerning.
Yeah.
Now, discerning is wisdom, right? And the compassionate, empathetic side is to allow more heart in the world. So I think it has a way of sort of performing a kind of healing of the world to have people with OCD carry something that's special about the message. And I wanted that specifically to be there, because I think often people with OCD think, I don't have something special, I have this disorder. But underneath this disorder, you have these wonderful qualities and capacities that are necessary and so important and valuable right now.
Yeah. Well, and disordered, you know, when we talk about mental health disorders, we're talking really about how it impacts people's ability to function in different settings, right? And so I think sometimes when, if we zoom out and culture is kind of looking at people with mental health disorders, it's pathologized in this way of like, oh, something's wrong with you. And if we can even shift the conversation of understanding, it's not that something's wrong with me, but something is getting in the way, tripping. It's a fire untamed. We'll stick with that, right? And learning how to garner that fire and how to cultivate and create goodness with it, or to stamp it out when it is causing destruction or harm, et cetera, is useful not only for that person's mental health, but like you said, the ripple effect that can have societally would be huge if people would lean in and allow room for that instead of going, ugh, you're the problem, you need to get better. And the medical model kind of sets us up for that because it's you folks out here in the fringe that don't act like us, quote unquote, normal folk. You need to kind of fix this thing about yourself and you can reintegrate into regular life. And really, if we could learn, hey, what helped you be able to manage this situation and shared that knowledge in terms of a functional management and context and all those different attributes that you were talking about, I think would be such a helpful tool. And realizing that we're more alike than different and we're better together in that.
And the other thing that I think is surprising about that is I know that people talk about how long it takes to get properly treated or even diagnosed with OCD. But I have a sneaking suspicion it's also because we don't focus enough on the lived depths of this. And if it felt like people got more of this nuance and could address this nuance, I think people would gravitate towards treatment a lot quicker. Not just because we know that there's a certain percentage of people who, let's say, don't want to go for exposure response prevention or will drop out quickly, right? But it's also because if we don't see something, if people with OCD don't see something that really gets at the nuance and complexity, it's not going to attract them.
Right.
So I see this as an exciting thing for us in the field to see how we can add more out there to make it seem like, hey, you've got a lot of wonderful things and we can help you with this thing that's on your back. We could do both.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't have to choose anymore.
Yeah. Doesn't that sound nice? Again, I like that it's not pitted up against versus it's just another way of understanding and embracing the whole person, including these harder parts, right?
Well,
Mike, anything else before we get going today? Anything else you would want to add in? Like you said before, the first book you wrote was for practitioners, but really this is for people with lived experience and family members. You absolutely could latch on and enjoy that radical hope offered through the book as well.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I wrote this book very specifically, not just for people with OCD, but for people who want to understand them better. And I also wrote this book with a lot of metaphor, with a lot of playful imagery, with a lot of case examples, and even these cameo appearances with some of my story and stories of these notable people with OCD, because I wanted this book to not just be illuminating and validating, I wanted it to be entertaining.
Yeah.
So you'll see that there's a lot of heart and soul in it. And if it reads different than other OCD books out there, I'm glad because I wanted it to be something new for you.
Yeah.
I've read all the books too, and I love them, but I wanted to just add something a little different so that you can get excited and inspired in your way.
Yeah. Well, I have a copy of the book that you sent over, and I'm excited to read it. 'Tis a busy season between when we first chatted, so I haven't had a chance to dive in yet, but that is, I look forward to reading it. And I'm thinking of that line from Gladiator, are you not entertained? But I think our brain needs some of that too. OCD is so heavy, it takes up all the oxygen in the room, right? And so many people are coming in so exhausted and hopeless, really.
Yeah, even feeling that is such an important therapeutic experience. I wanted people to feel how brilliant, how exciting, how sensitive and heartfelt and open the OCD mind and heart is when you get to know it on these different terms.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And then being able to, it's so much easier to hold hope and hold joy when you're not trying to stop or lose, kind of minimize parts of yourself that you're like, I can't.
Yeah. And yeah, if you don't feel hope after reading this book, go to your nearest emergency room. Because I wrote this book to be such a like screaming from the rooftops of how wonderful and lovely people with OCD are and why they should love themselves more.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I think we can't end on a better note than that. Well, thank you, Mike, so much for your time and for all of the really commitment and drive that you had to explore this conceptualization of OCD. Because like you said, it does require being creative. And again, sometimes there's not a lot of room, particularly in science. We're not being creative. We're running experiments and we're doing this. But really, you know, something I will tell clients too is, why are we doing the experiments? Because we're trying to answer a question, right? We're trying to learn something. We're trying to explore or expand, right? And so it's worth being able to research. And if you've researched it and it's always been done a certain way, then it can be really challenging to provide new ways and find new paths. And the ways that exist are excellent, but they don't help everyone. And so it's not good enough to be like, well, try again later, or sorry about your luck. Like, we got to just continue to figure these things out and allow the humanity and agency to shine through, just like it did, whether we're landing on the moon or something else. So thank you so much for taking the time and hanging out with the fam today.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for finding our way to the moon together. It's been fun.
Absolutely. Intrusive thoughts. Okay, fam. What did you think? It's definitely a different approach to conceptualizing OCD if you've been around for a hot minute or are currently drinking through the fire hose, no pun intended with all this fire analogy, but just learning and inundating yourself with what OCD is, how it works, how it functions, and how we treat it. I think it's also a very welcomed take on OCD as well. And if you caught my 2025 guide at the beginning of this year, then you may have heard a snippet from Mike and his focus on the upside of OCD, because I included it as one of those approaches I want to be more curious about and that I am supporting. So again, my thanks to Mike for taking the time to chat with the fam. I appreciate all the great analogies, particularly as someone who thinks and processes life in analogies. But above all, I appreciate the creativity and the emotional flexibility that he brought to our conversations. So that brings us to the intrusive thought segment, which is the application segment of my show for any newer fam joining us. It's that time where we think about what we discussed today and we try to figure out a way to apply it. So let's get back to this idea of the fire. Honestly, I can't escape thinking about the wildfires literally on some level, but I also really love the duality we explored regarding how fire, which can create heat, warmth, power, and strength, can also get wildly out of control, dangerous, or destructive. And so I'm leaning in, fam, and here's the application. First, I want you to identify your sparks. And by sparks, I want you to think of this as your creativity or even your sensitivity that have led to something positive or insightful for yourself. And fam, though this is the OCD Family Podcast, this is an exercise we can all practice, and I think there's something in it for all of us. So what are some of the sparks you have in your life? Because honoring each part of us, it's so important. Jot it down and think about this. How did that spark get created? How did it feel in that moment? Whether it was about growing and connecting in a relationship or solving a problem, or maybe just a form of self-expression. What was that like? What positivity did that yield? What insightfulness did that bring? Then, number two, I want you to think of at least one wildfire moment. This would be a time when your creativity or sensitivity felt more out of control or even raging. What brought this wildfire about? How did it grow? And without judgment, did it teach you anything? Did it illuminate something? Next, number three, I want us all to try and zoom out and try to reframe the flames.
How can we see our wildfire moments as fitting into our unique emotional and creative makeup? Because yes, while the fire may have gotten away from us, it served a function, as we discussed more in depth today. And to that end, because we can see the usefulness or helpfulness of those sparks, how might we help guide that fire in future instances? Or what are some measures we could do to help contain it so it can continue to serve us instead of feeling like it's growing out of control or going wild? And then last but not least, I want to challenge you, family, to think of at least one, but hey, maybe even a few small ways that you can practice letting your sparks shine in constructive ways this week. Because we can practice making and creating room for these strengths and containing the sparks. Here's what this exercise could look like for me. Number one, I have a lot of empathy and care, as I mentioned both last week and at the top of this episode, for my beloved LA community. And that has led me to sharing some tips and resources, to texting and checking on friends, sending care packages, and even creating a crisis management episode last week on the pod. So the sparks, or even remaining embers from my sparks, were able to offer some good support, even in the midst of despair. But number two, this also led to a wildfire of my own. I felt drained and somewhat helpless, now several hundred miles away from where everything was actually happening. I felt disconnected from my community and displaced, worried that my attempts would come off as nothing more than virtue signaling. I felt guilty that some of my friends and some of my colleagues even have lost their homes, have lost their everything, and here I am feeling grumpy about the inconvenience of needing to do the dishes or disparities that really pale in comparison. And this affected my mood. This affected the ways I showed up with my kids or for my spouse. It led to more doom scrolling and an absolute absorption into this ongoing trauma through social media, YouTube, the news, all of it. Which then leads me to the third step, trying to reframe the flames. So my empathy is part of what makes me special. It makes me a fierce advocate for others and a good listener and a trusted helper. But I wasn't able to reel it in when I was eating, sleeping, and breathing YouTube coverage, constantly checking in for safety checks from my LA community friends and watching live maps of the fire spread, staring at texts, waiting for red receipts. So in an effort to honor my empathetic self, but also practice some sort of containment, I determined I needed to put my phone down. I needed to close YouTube. It wasn't serving me, unless it was simply for fun, like how to practice a new art technique or learning how to do something new. I had to tell myself I can care and check my phone once a day, see where the fire is at, but that checking more often would not serve me or my loved ones. That I could wait to hear from people rather than continuously seeing, did they check in? Did they mark themselves as safe? And I could choose to engage to be present with my kids. Whether playing a game or snuggling or listening to my eldest practice his piano versus wondering what else has burnt down that used to be a place of gathering for me. I can choose to be available for non-emergent friend connections at least once a week so that I'm not overextending myself, but I can be helpful in bite-sized ways. Also, I can take the time to point people to the episode that we created last week if they ask for tips on coping or how to manage this because they're really struggling. Because ultimately, that's why we created that episode, to provide that support. And I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I can point to the wheel and say, here, I've got you. I don't have to regurgitate and relive and reabsorb myself into a situation that ultimately doesn't allow me to be more functional, but more distressed. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I can put my phone down and I can walk away. Because for me, the phone becomes oxygen to my already really hot sparks. And if I don't want that fire to rage out of control, then to the extent that I can, that's going to be helpful for me. So what will you practice this week, fam? Because the delicious misery in all of this is just that. It's both good and challenging. It's both functional and at times able to become destructive. But if we only focus on the uglier, more challenging parts, then we are missing all the good, all the beauty, all the upsides within. So take some time to honor your upsides this week. And thanks to Mike again for helping to guide the way. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there.
It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the down low on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Michael LC chatting about the upside of OCD. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.